This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, later on Building Bridges.
Walmart, a template for 21st century capitalism, with labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein.
But first, Alberto Gonzalez, a record of injustice. As Senator Herb Kohl said during John Ashcroft's nomination hearing, not only must the president trust the attorney general, the nation must also trust him, for after all, the attorney general is America's lawyer. White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, President Bush's new pick for attorney general, is not a lawyer Americans can trust. Well, I'm glad to have with us Jod Legum, Deputy Research Director of American Progress Action Fund.
Good evening.
Now, why in the world is not Attorney General nominee Alberto Gonzalez someone that we can trust?
I think if you look at his record, both as White House counsel, as Texas Chief Legal Counsel, his record on the Texas Supreme Court, I think that what you see is a record of somebody who holds radical beliefs in many instances, beliefs that are way out of the mainstream. And in the most recent case, with the memos he wrote as White House counsel, someone who was willing to turn decades of international law that the United States took the lead in creating and turning it on its head. And so I think that record, viewed in its totality, raises a lot of very serious questions about his ability and to conduct himself and have a successful tenure as Attorney General.
Now, I want to parse out some of the issues relevant to Alberto Gonzalez, particularly given the fact that many of the Mexican-American organizations like the American-Mexican Legal Defense Fund and other groups with a Latino base were more circumspect about the nomination. In fact, they applauded Bush for nominating somebody of Hispanic extraction. And it doesn't seem that they are going to take a very aggressive, vociferous stand during the nomination process. So I want to be very careful in how we look at and why we are saying the things that we do against that backdrop. Now, why don't we begin by Gonzalez approving the memos that authorized torture? Why don't you lay that out for us, please?
Well, in August 2002, the Justice Department wrote a memo. But this memo was really written at the direction of and was vetted by Alberto Gonzalez. And what this memo said was that laws prohibiting a torture don't apply to the president when they're detaining or interrogating enemy combatant, and that the president could authorize torture. And this memo is part of a puzzle that many people believe created a culture, a permissive culture, that led to the horrific abuse in Abu Ghraib prison and elsewhere around the world of detainees in U.S. custody.
Actually, tell us a bit more about how these memos came to light as well, because that's another important issue.
I think these memos came into light. I think initially Newsweek obtained this memo, so that's how it came to light initially. But they came to light in the wake of the Abu Ghraib scandal, as there was a variety of investigations were looking into, well, how did we create a culture in which U.S. military personnel are treating detainees in a way that's contrary to their own guidelines, and it's contrary to the way in which the United States has treated detainees, and also contrary to international law. And it pointed back to these memos, both the August 2002 memo that I talked about just a second ago, maybe, but also the January 2002, in a separate memo where Alberto Gonzalez said, in fact, that the war against terrorism makes international law like the Geneva Convention obsolete, and called many of the provisions in the Geneva Convention quaint. So this is clearly someone in the Attorney General nominee, Gonzalez, who doesn't have a great deal of respect for international law and for the role of international law in the United States. And that, when you're looking at someone who's the nation's chief law enforcement officer, is quite troubling.
And moving on to other issues with regard to, say, the death penalty and his advice to then-Governor Bush, how would you describe that, and what does that portend for the future?
Well, what happened with that was, as Texas chief legal counsel, he held a similar role advising President Bush that he does today when President Bush was governor. He's now as chief counsel in the White House. But one of his duties then as chief legal counsel was to present a memo to Governor Bush which said, laid out the case of, here are the various factors that you should consider before making the final approval to execute someone. At least that was what he was supposed to do. What he actually did was, in many cases, present a very horrific, very bombastic description of the crime and the cruelty of the crime, but left out key details that should have been considered by Governor Bush as mitigating factors, such as ineffective counsel, conflict of interest, mitigating evidence, even actual evidence of innocence. And this, there was a review of these documents by the Atlantic Monthly, and they concluded that as a result, really, President Bush didn't have the information he needed to make an informed decision. And this doesn't portend well for his upcoming tenure, what everyone expects is his upcoming tenure as Attorney General, because he's going to be in charge of instituting the federal death penalty and deciding when the United States is going to pursue the death penalty versus various people. And it's clear that he doesn't, or at least from what we've seen with these memos, he doesn't adequately appreciate the seriousness and the care that one should go about before imposing the death penalty.
I want to move back from when he worked for Bush in Texas to his tenure at the White House, because there's so many other issues to explore there. And I say this because, again, there's great concern that when we for example, when the legal community and others organized when Clarence Thomas was nominated for a Supreme Court seat, groups like the Black Law Students Organization, National Conference of Black Lawyers, really stepped up to the plate. This position of Gonzalez, should he obtain it, is really opening the door and offering permission for him to become the next Supreme Court justice. And it really boggles my mind that there seems to be such a tepid response to really laying out what this man's enormously, ideologically grounded, destructive record has been since he's been in the White House.
That's right, Mimi. And I think that what we're seeing here is an effort to give Gonzalez a chance to prove his bona fides to the conservative community. But because he only served for a brief time on the Texas Supreme Court, the right wing is uncomfortable right now with Bush pointing him to the Supreme Court. So this is seen as an effort to give Gonzalez a few years to prove that he is, quote-unquote, on the reservation on these issues and will be a consistent advocate for right-wing, fairly radical causes on a variety of issues, on reproductive rights issues, on some of these social issues where he doesn't have such a thick record.
I want to flesh out just more carefully the Geneva Convention provisions as viewed as obsolete and what the political consequences of these kinds of memos and these kinds of suggestions are, what the implications for our troops are, and human rights within the arena of war.
Quite frankly,
which
the
sounds
reason,
like a bit of an oxymoron when you talk about human rights in the war arena, but
right. Exactly, but in a certain extent, you're absolutely right, because what the Geneva Convention was and what all of these other international anti-torture provisions and the like were was to set up a system whereby you could have a situation where there's a greater chance that U.S. troops are treated well when they get captured by an enemy, and to make sure there's a set of guidelines that the whole international community ascribes to before anything happens that says, if we capture an enemy, we'll adhere to these guidelines and treat them, you know, relatively well. And what happens when you have somebody like Alberto Gonzalez advising the president and telling him that he's free to ignore these kinds of issues and these kinds of protections, you endanger U.S. troops when they're captured by the enemy, as they undoubtedly will at some point in the future, and you endanger the likelihood that they'll be treated with the kind of care that the Geneva Convention provides for. And that should be very troubling for anyone who cares about the future and the safety of our troops.
Do you see any likelihood that the Democrats will really pose a hard line of questioning towards him and really try to hold up the confirmation given these facts?
Well, I see no likelihood that they're going to try to hold up the confirmation, because Patrick Leahy, who's the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee that's going to be considering his nomination has already come out and been very supportive of Gonzalez. I think there's a greater chance, and I hope that there's Democrats or anyone really on the committee to ask questions, because I think that unless people think that they're going to be called to task for these things, unless they think someone's going to try to hold them to some degree of accountability or at the very least scrutiny, the next time they're going to feel free to do it again or even go further. So I think that there's a real obligation and there's a real opportunity for somebody on that committee to show that they care about these issues and they're willing to do something that, you know, might not put them in the good graces of the administration or even some of the Democratic leadership, but may be the right thing to do.
Judd, I think we should also lay out some of his feelings about military tribunals and civilian participation and various other constructs still that came specifically out of Gonzalez with his role in the White House. And actually, one would appear that he was even somewhat to the right of Ashcroft.
That's right. It was Gonzalez who, in fact, pushed the idea that enemy combatants didn't need to go to a United States court, that they didn't need a whole variety of protections even in these military tribunals. They didn't need a whole variety of protections that are provided in U.S. courts, evidentiary rules, rules about having access to the evidence that's presented against you, and created what we've seen in Guantanamo, which are these sort of show courts that have been discredited even by the Supreme Court, which by all accounts is quite conservative on in most respects, and the legal system, which has done a lot to, in my mind, sully the reputation of the United States as sort of the premier legal, one of the premier legal systems as far as fairness and as far as equality around the world in the eyes of many of our friends and allies. And so I think that's a serious question, and one in which Gonzalez's views have already been discredited by the Supreme Court.
Well, there are many more things to discuss, and we certainly will in the weeks and months that come about Alberto Gonzalez. And we'd like to thank you for that capsule, that snapshot of Alberto Gonzalez.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been speaking with Judd Legum, Deputy Research Director, American Progress Action Fund.
Said I love the lie, lie the love, hanging on with push and shove. Possession is the motivation, hanging up the whole damn nation.
At the dawn of the 21st century, U.S. retail giant Walmart has emerged as the kind of world-transforming economic institution that General Motors and the Pennsylvania Railroad had been in America's past. Already the U.S.'s biggest employer, estimates are that Walmart will double its sales and employ at least 2.2 million worldwide by 2008.
Beginning in Arkansas in the Ozarks, Walmart came from a region of the country where a kind of low-wage, low-benefit, almost rural American world was the norm. Clearly, Walmart, now the largest firm in the nation today, is setting a standard that other firms have to follow if they hope to compete.
The Walmart-led race to the bottom is seen in the U.S. in its retail stores and abroad in the manufacturers it selects to produce the products it sells. It has reversed a 100-year-old history in which the manufacturer was powerful and the retailer was the vassal. Now the mass global retailer is the power and the manufacturer becomes the underling who has to do the bidding of the retailer. The manufacturers that Walmart selects are increasingly located in underdeveloped countries, which must compete for Walmart's business, leading to a ratcheting down of already low wages and working conditions in the underdeveloped economies around the world.
Labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein is one of the leading analysts of the new discipline, which we can almost call Walmart Studies. He helped to organize a path-breaking conference, Walmart, Template for 21st Century Capitalism, last year at the University of Santa Barbara, and is working on a new book on Walmart, which will be released soon. Lichtenstein recently spoke at a conference on the future of the labor movement organized by Queen College Labor Resource Center. Now, Nelson Lichtenstein.
Yeah. Walmart has been mentioned as a metaphor for the problems that confront working people, the problem, the transformations in American and world capitalism, and I think that's very much the case. It has become this 800-pound gorilla, this beast, metaphors of empire. It's all true. Walmart is not alone, but certainly now that it is the largest corporation in terms of both number of workers and in terms of sales in the world. So it's something we have to deal with, think about, figure out how to organize. Efforts are being made, the necessity to do it. But I want to just stand back a little bit just now and talk about why is this corporation and part of a transformation in world capitalism so that we can at least get a feel for what we're up against. First of all, it is huge. It has $300 billion in sales. The Economist and other journals estimate they'll have $1 trillion in sales in a decade. So it's gigantic. It employs 1.4 million. And around the world. It's the biggest private employer in the U.S., in Canada, and in Mexico. It imports more from China than either the United Kingdom or Russia. It's not just big, of course. Walmart now really sets the standards, really legislates. If you want to know where social legislation is taking place in America today, you go to Bentonville, the executive office. It is setting the social standards, the industrial policy for the United States. It sets the real minimum wage in many parts of the country, establishes the health care system by its competition with other firms who have better health care benefits, and they seek to bring them down to the Walmart level. It really conducts a kind of international diplomacy, especially in China and Central America. I think Walmart is a template corporation for our era of capitalism. It's so big that it's setting the standards for the way other corporations function, and that's been referred to by lots of people, the Walmartization of work, of corporations, etc. I compare Walmart to other great American corporations of the past. The Pennsylvania Railroad in the 19th century described itself as the standard of the world. The General Motors in the mid-20th century was the corporation that was emulated. More recently, IBM, later Microsoft. Well, Walmart is becoming this kind of corporation. What Walmart is doing as part of a larger political movement, but also very directly in terms of its own structure, its own organization, its own policies, it is battling what remains of New Deal America. The fights that are taking place now in California and Chicago and maybe New York State really is because this corporation, as it moves into these areas which have had the strongest representation, if we think of New Deal regulation of corporate power, New Deal, post-New Deal, Great Society, wage and benefit levels, the battles that have been sparked as a result of that are this contest that's taking place. One reason it's able to do this, an economy which is now so dominated by service institutions by retail rather than manufacturing, is that Walmart has successfully made the retailer king and the manufacturer the vassal. For most of American industrial history, you manufacture the goods, that was where the power was, and the retailers were the ones who sold them. But Walmart has successfully succeeded in making the center of power in American capitalism, certainly, and possibly world capitalism, the retailer. Manufacturers have to scramble to meet the requirements set by companies like Walmart, and then, of course, they're being emulated by every other retailer. Yes, there is a transformation taking place in the world economy, but it does not have to be beyond our reach to have something to say about it and how it will be structured. And I think right now, and I'm in California, it became absolutely manifestly clear a year ago during the great grocery strike, which lasted 4.5 months, that Walmart was the unseen presence at the bargaining table. Just absolutely clear. And in almost every other political moment since then, Walmart has had a role. Walmart's actual presence in California is fairly modest, but its specter is having a tremendous impact. Turns out that Proposition 72, which mandated that large firms have to pay health benefits, which is one of Walmart's great competitive advantages, is that it pays about $2,000 less per employee than grocery stores or other, even Sears or someplace like that. So it's a fiercely conducted contest over that question. One of the elements of Walmart's success, its presence, and its really creation of itself almost into a kind of the corporate side of the American empire is the logistics revolution, of which the 40-foot-long metal container is the absolute icon. There are about 1 million of these containers sailing to and fro between Hong Kong, Singapore, and Long Beach and Los Angeles. It's a continuous stream. The efficiency of this containerization, this container revolution, which has been there since the 70s, but is now at full capacity. What it means is that South China, which has 40 million newly proletarianized workers there, South China is now part of the American political economy in a way that was never the case before. And you can stuff the Mattel doll or the bicycle onto a container in the port of Hong Kong. Actually, you can make it only a week earlier, and 3 weeks later, it's in a store in Peoria, Illinois. It's very efficient, and it's very fast. And just one thing, Walmart wants to make Charleston, South Carolina, a container port which will be of enormous size. And one reason for that tremendous battle that was fought over the longshoremen in South Carolina was because a company like Walmart, which buys its products for 25 cents an hour in South China and sells them for clerks who make $8 an hour in Peoria, it wasn't going to stand for $30 or $40 or $50 an hour longshoremen in either the West Coast or in Charleston. So that's part of the reason the Longshore Union is at a crucial juncture here. These containers from South China and other places, they are pulled across the Pacific. They are not pushed. What do I mean by that? In the old days, when you made a car or a refrigerator, the manufacturer had a long run. They tried to get the prices and the costs down as best they could, but they knew that long runs of production produce over time low prices. And therefore, they made a lot of them, and then they pushed them on to the dealers and said, okay, sell this stuff. And that's one reason that car dealers have been in a chronic war with Detroit, because they get pushed. Walmart does not do that. Walmart pulls the containers in South China. It is deployed the latest computer and telecommunications technology so that the scanning devices in the store are linked directly to the supply purchasing computers in Bentonville, which are then linked directly to the Sichuan main office of Walmart in South China. And so they are able to tell the manufacturer in China, or it could be in America or Mexico, exactly what they need and exactly when they need it. It enables Walmart to know exactly what it wants and to bid very rapidly among a variety of employers as to who will give the lowest price. And Walmart would bring these manufacturers literally into the room in China or in Bentonville. They would have an auction, a downward auction into price. It translates Walmart's enormous purchasing power directly onto labor so that the price of labor is ratcheted down, down, down on a continuous basis all the time. Walmart's ratcheting down of labor costs. It has some 3,000 Chinese suppliers. These suppliers, some of them are very large. The largest shoe manufacturing facility in the world will be in Vietnam, and it's the Huyen Binh Chan mega factory. It will employ 65,000 people. Other factories in China employ 10,000, 15,000. But it used to be in American industrial history, when you had that many people in one place, there was a kind of economic and sort of decision-making power that went with it, if not among the workers, at least among the people who own the factories. But here, while you have this tremendous proletarianization that's taking place, the capacity of a company like Walmart to switch orders from one place to the other means that this huge industrial concentration, it lacks that kind of certainly economic power, and it cannot set the price that the retailer has to take. Instead, Walmart sets that price. And that's happening in the U.S. today. For example, Procter & Gamble, you know, you've all used their toothpaste. It used to be that they were kind of a bully when it came to the retailer. They would go to the five and dime store and say, you know, you got to put this stuff on the shelf, take our price for it, and that's the end of it. If you don't, we'll pull our stuff out of the store. In the 80s, Procter & Gamble and Walmart had a kind of a cat fight. It went on for a while. Walmart won. Now P&G's factories are literally controlled by the computers at Bentonville, which tell P&G precisely what to make and at what time and at what price. And so P&G is now part of this inexorable lowering the price level and wage level continuously. One other point. I said that Walmart is versus New Deal America. Walmart came out of Arkansas at a time, really northwestern Arkansas, when it was founded. Its labor policies, its whole culture was based upon a kind of part of the South before the civil rights movement, before the feminist movement, really before the regulatory reforms of the New Deal were put in place. And Walmart was smart in not moving its second generation of stores to, you know, Seattle or New York or San Francisco. It spread like molasses through tier after tier of rural counties, which meant that Walmart was able to maintain the Southern patriarchal culture as it went along. It had a very, very vigorous and self-contained managerial culture, which now, again, we're sort of confronting as it moves now, finally, into California or Illinois or New York. What is to be done, as it were? What is to be done? I think the coalitions are forming and conducting political fights against Walmart. Inglewood rejected a referendum which would have put a Walmart supercenter in downtown Inglewood as a result, because Walmart was trying to move around the city council. It was a kind of a very arrogant, undemocratic effort to get the zoning law changed. People have many different motives for opposing Walmart. Some don't like its aesthetics. Some think it'll ruin Main Street business. Others don't like its social policies, its labor policies, etc. Whatever the reason, I think these coalitions have and will be and are being encouraged by the labor movement, which I think will be the backbone of that. And I think the goal of this political mobilization against Walmart is to say, we welcome you into our community if you're willing to pay wages which will afford a decent living, if you're willing to pay health benefits which are not exorbitant to your workers, and if you don't deprive taxpayers through the back door of money for your workers because they can't earn enough, but you're paying them, they have to go to welfare, and they have to go to various social services. If we can change the business model of Walmart, then I think that will be a first success for these coalitions. Once Walmart has a business model in which it has a permanent workforce, today the turnover rate is 46% by its own figures, once it has a permanent workforce and a higher pay wage workforce, then the possibility of unionism becomes a real possibility, and I think that we can make tremendous progress even against this 800-pound gorilla. Thank you.
You've been listening to labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein. This has been a Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special.